Think of the life cycle of a company, said Dad. The company is founded to meet a need and solve a problem. They solve that problem and meet that need, and probably over some number of years, the problem or the need becomes obsolete. There are very few companies that last 100 years. Notice where a company is in that life cycle, and what gives it a long-lasting, durable, intrinsic competitive advantage to stick around as long as possible. Is this moat you and Charlie are talking about different from a company doing a good job when it comes to meeting a need or solving a problem? Totally, totally different. What makes a moat different from pure competitive advantage is that it is a competitive advantage that is first intrinsic to the business and second, durable. Intrinsic to the business means that their advantage cannot be separated from their business. It's inherently there. Durable means that it is so difficult or expensive, or both, to overcome that intrinsic characteristic that no competitor is going to try. So we can expect that it's going to continue for a long time to come. Sounds like a typical competitive advantage to me. It's not at all. This is competitive advantage that can't easily disappear. Ask yourself whether it's possible to start a company that would compete and take over that company. The answer is that it's always possible. Maybe. So the next question is, how much would it cost for a new competitor to get started and grow to the level of being able to compete with and beat our company? If the cost is so huge that no one would do it, it's impracticable, then you know our moat is pretty strong. Okay. Think of durability from the opposite perspective, Dad suggested. Is a company you're researching just trying to compete with a Me Too product that is priced lower than competitive products? Are some of these companies making typewriters at the beginning of the personal computer? Are these going to be going strong in 10 years? Or maybe not? So if nothing was going to threaten it, I considered, its competitive advantage was incredibly strong. And the intrinsic quality, like they're the first ones into an industry or something like that, that would be intrinsic to the business. Exactly like that, Dad replied. Being the first mover into an industry is even part of one of the kinds of moats I'm going to teach you. There are kinds of moats? He had so much energy now he couldn't even keep it in. He started bouncing in his chair. Oh, there are many kinds of moats. 5 kinds, maybe 6. The 5.5 moats. 1. Brand. When a company has a brand that is so strong that it would be very difficult for another company to create an equally strong brand to compete with them, sometimes created by being the first mover into an industry and thereby having that industry identified with them. Example, Coca-Cola and Pepsi. Pepsi has spent millions to improve its brand and compete with Coca-Cola and has created a strong brand. Still, Coca-Cola is stronger, especially worldwide. In some regions, people even say they want a Coke instead of saying they want a soda, no matter what type of soda they're actually asking for. With a great brand moat, customers think in terms of the brand name rather than the generic name of the product. Coke, not cola. Harley, not motorcycle. iPhone, not smartphone. Kleenex, not facial tissue. 2. Switching. When it is very difficult, expensive, or painful for a customer to switch away from using a company's products or services. Example, Apple computer products are an integrated environment using one operating system. As a user of an Apple iPhone, laptop, and iPad, I can confirm that it would be difficult, painful, and expensive to switch to an Android or Microsoft system. That doesn't mean I can't or I won't switch. But the pain of switching deters me, even if my current products are not as good as their competition. 2.5, network effects. A subset of the switching moat, when a company provides an exclusive network to which the user wants access. The act of switching itself is not difficult, but switching away from the network would mean losing that access. Example, Facebook. That said, those of us who used Friendster know very well that all that has to happen for this network effects moat to be breached is for people in your personal network to switch to a different host. Still, there is a certain quantity of users before this moat gets established or broken. 3. Toll bridge. When a company has a monopoly or near monopoly in their industry, that is, a toll bridge is the only product in a big niche. This is usually created by government regulations or intervention, which of course can change. Other kinds of toll bridge moats are geographic or driven by the unbelievable cost to enter a market, or all of the above. Example. The Intercontinental Railroad is my dad's favorite example of a toll bridge moat. Burlington Northern Railroad controls the railroad tracks. It's not that another company can't build a railroad, but the government regulations, the expense, and the right of way it would have to procure make doing so for all practical purposes impossible. 4. Secrets. When a company has proprietary secrets that protect it from other companies copying it, these might take the form of patents or trade secrets or other forms of intellectual property. Examples. A pharmaceutical company like Pfizer or Merck with a patent on drugs has a strong secrets moat until that patent runs its term and generics can be made. A company like 3M might choose not to patent an invention to avoid announcing how to create it, a requirement of patent filing, and instead protect it as a trade secret to keep it well hidden from reverse engineering. 5. Price. When a company is the low-cost provider because it can make its product or provide its service more cheaply than anyone else, and it is intrinsically able to sustain that advantage. Example. Costco can sell their products cheaper than anyone else because they use their huge buying power and low display costs to have the most profit at any price point of any competitor. If they get in a price war with another company, they can drop their prices lower than anyone else can and still make money. Any company trying to compete with a nearby Costco on price would quickly become a cautionary tale of economic Darwinism. It was early May, and Dad and I got lucky with a clear and crisp Rocky Mountain weekend, so I suggested we go for a hike. I could think through these moats better in the foothills around Boulder. To me, the hard part of the moat wasn't determining if a company had a competitive advantage. I could make an argument that most decent companies had a competitive advantage. No, the hard part of moats was determining how intrinsic and durable a company's competitive advantage was. The key question was, is it really a full moat that is intrinsic and durable to the company? As we hiked up First Flatiron, I tested out analyzing two well-known companies mostly to myself, both of which I've already mentioned, Coca-Cola and Apple. They seem easy, right? Dad stayed relatively silent and let me work through my thoughts on my own while he focused on breathing steadily at a mile-high elevation. Both Coca-Cola and Apple are consumer-facing companies, which gave me the advantage of direct knowledge about and experience with them. I could understand them because I use their products, and because they're just about everywhere. I can go to a grocery store and see that Coca-Cola's display power is as strong as ever. And I can drop into an Apple store and see that it is the busiest store in the mall. Coca-Cola's moat is brand. Apple's moats are brand and switching. But it was easy for me to go down the rabbit hole, even with these companies. Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola has a brand moat, obviously. Does it also have a secrets moat? Their secret recipe for classic Coke from 1886 is one of the most famous company secrets. It has been reverse engineered by competitors, and recipes published in newspapers and online are said to be the original recipe. But the company still famously perpetuates the story that its recipe is a secret. The truth is that whether the recipes out there publicly are real or not, Coca-Cola uses its origin story to its advantage. It's probably not that hard to reverse engineer a beverage with the taste of Coke, but it is impossible to recreate the taste of Coke and package it in a Coke bottle or can, which adds that certain je ne sais quoi to its brand. Coke doesn't have a secrets moat at all. What it does have is an incredibly strong brand moat, in which the appearance of secrets is an important part of its brand mythology. Coca-Cola's secret formula has contributed to its mystery and therefore its brand moat. It's incredibly easy to choose a non-Coca-Cola product in the store, so they do not have a switching moat, nor do they have any toll bridge moat protection. But cans of Coke are awfully cheap. Do they also have a price moat? Nope, because they are not the low-cost provider of cola. A major part of their business model is to be inexpensive, often cheaper than bottled water, but not as cheap as generic store brands. The Coke brand still carries a price premium, which again, contributes to its strong brand moat. Do you really want to serve up generic cola at your party? I mean, come on. But I can argue the other way, too. Yes, Coca-Cola has an obvious brand, but how durable is it? Sugary sodas are becoming very unpopular in the United States and Europe the more they're linked to obesity. And there are even additional taxes on soda in some cities, such as New York, meant to deter buyers. Coca-Cola has already acted in response to that trend by buying beverage brands that stand for energy or health and nutrition, which it does not brand with the Coca-Cola name. Monster, Honest Tea, Smartwater, and Odwalla are all Coca-Cola owned. I really like Honest Tea. It was created to provide yummy, healthy drinks without additives and with organic ingredients, including fair trade certified tea. In short, these guys have a great healthy food mission I love and a great tasting product that I buy. And it is now owned by Coca-Cola. But you would never know that without some digging. For a socially conscious product that's aiming for the health food market, Coca-Cola's brand would probably harm Honest Tea rather than help it. Coca-Cola has used its display power in grocery stores to get Honest Tea a lot of shelf space it couldn't have gotten without the Coca-Cola brand power, but has hidden their connection. As a potential investor, I look at Coca-Cola's investment in new products for a very different market than their core market, and I see vision and preparation for the future. Coca-Cola's sodas are still massively popular worldwide, and probably will continue to be for longer than 10 years from now, but they are focusing on new brands anyway. Buffett himself has been excoriated for owning Coca-Cola shares because of the cola's sugar content. But I was starting to see why the master stayed with that company. Coke's brand moat looked good. Apple. Apple has a brand moat, obviously. It's also bloody difficult and painful to switch from an Apple platform to a PC, or from an iPhone to an Android phone, so it has a switching moat. But just as with Coca-Cola's moat, I can argue the other way. It's not impossible to switch away from Apple, and if it becomes unwieldy to use Apple products, the relative pain of switching becomes lessened and lessened. Apple has changed since Steve Jobs passed away, and I'm not impressed. I can easily buy a roughly Apple-equivalent personal computer or smartphone from any of its competitors, and Apple is only getting more expensive. However, Apple does own thousands of patents, has an incredible operating system, and has a strong culture of product secrecy, so I would say it has a secrets moat. With its brand and secrets moats, it's going strong, but its switching moat is weakening, with poor decisions on user interfaces like iTunes, and by driving the prices up on its products. I'm not impressed by Apple's competitive advantages because I'm not sure they rise to the level of moats. I gave my dad a rundown of my argument for each one. Competitors attack a moat in basically two ways, he said. First, by saying, I'm going to do what you do, but cheaper or better. Or two, I'm going to do something that eliminates the need for you. I nodded. The second is being a typewriter company when the computer came around. Exactly. If you're facing that kind of obsolescence, there's nothing you can do about it except foresee it and sell your company. Or join the new wave, as IBM did. IBM is a selling machine that has a switching moat, and they have held their switching moat by buying new technology as it comes out and providing it to their customers quickly enough that it's not worthwhile for them to switch. And the first, cheaper or better? I mean, every single company is attacked on price constantly. Right. What keeps customers from leaving is the moat. It could be that the company has a brand as a high-quality product, or it could be easier not to switch, or the company could lower its prices to match its competitions. You should be able to anticipate how a company you choose will handle those moat attacks by looking at how they've handled them in the past. Apple has been repeatedly attacked for 40 years, and they're still here. But you don't only have to depend on your subjective research to know how strong they are. I stared at him blankly. I don't? Nope, he grinned. There are numbers.
Oh, no.
Don't panic, said Dad. There are only a few numbers you need, and I'm going to tell you exactly where to find them on the financial statements when we get back to your house later. That will give us much better information about how strong the moats are.
Oh, Lord. It couldn't be time for the financial statements already. I thought I would be able to avoid dealing with numbers until our discussion rolled around to Charlie's fourth principle about price.
I took a deep breath and remembered that I had tackled financial statements in law school and had handled that just fine. But I felt so unaccountably nervous about it now. Sure, Dad could tell me which lines on the statements to read, but I needed to understand what those numbers meant to be capable of understanding a company. This was where the whole investing thing might break down for me. At least I'd find out sooner rather than later.
A note from Phil. The SEC requires public companies to file their financial statements according to a standard set of accounting principles determined by a board of accountants called the Generally Accepted Accounting Principles, GAAP. In financial statements, a public company will provide standard GAAP-compliant accounting. Additionally, it will often provide non-GAAP accounting for a different picture of how the company is doing financially. Check the explanations and the footnotes in the financial statements to know how the company calculates these non-GAAP numbers, because they are often designed to mislead an investor into thinking the company is doing better than it is actually doing. Anytime they use adjusted earnings or EBITDA, earnings before interest, tax, depreciation, and amortization, be suspicious and skeptical. Financial statements. Income statement. How much money are you making? Revenue. How many expenses do you have? Subtract expenses from revenue and get your profit. Profit is how much you have left over. You make a salary of $80,000. Your expenses this year were $75,000, and you have $5,000 left over as profit. Balance sheet. What do you own? Assets. What do you owe? Liabilities. And what's left? You own your house and a car and an inheritance from your grandma, and it adds up to $500,000. And you owe $400,000 on the house and $10,000 on the car, so your liabilities are $410,000. What's left is the $90,000 that you could actually get if you sell everything and pay off everybody. Cash flow statement. How much actual cash you have in the bank tells you the actual cash you spent and got from the business operations, operating cash, cash that went to investing in equipment or buying a business or came in from selling part of the business, investing cash, cash from loans or stock sales, financing cash. This statement is necessary for public companies because they use accrual accounting, which lets companies count as income payments that haven't actually come in yet and expenses as they are owed rather than when they are paid. The cash flow statement lets us know what's actually in the bank account. You know the money arrives from selling your house, but the money won't land in your bank account until escrow closes in 3 weeks. It will not show up on your cash flow statement until the cash comes in.
As we continued on our hike, I tried to feel my feet being heavy and grounded into the dirt and rocks below me with each step. The concentration helped with the shaky feeling of panic that had hit me behind my eyes. Okay, I said, let's do this. How can numbers tell me anything about something as intangible as a moat? Dad smiled. They're hugely important clues. Remember that the real point of a moat, this intrinsic characteristic that helps a company remain durable, is the ability to roughly predict the future. That's the whole point of it. So we want to see that four major numbers are consistent over time, because that might mean these numbers are predictable in the future.
A big, durable moat should let the future look a lot like the past. If the moat is good enough to be consistent in the past and predictable for the future, then we know something about what we're getting. If there's no reason to suspect it's going to change, it's so much easier for us to understand the business, roughly predict the future cash flow, and find the value. We finished our hike, and once we got home, Dad ordered in dinner. He wasn't taking any chances of me getting out of this one. It was our first discussion of financial numbers. Big moment. He listed the moat numbers found on the financial statements that he would want to see grow each year. Dad calls them the Big Four numbers. I'm going to tell you about the Big Four numbers, and we've also made a reference table for you on the enhancement PDF. Big Four numbers. Number one, net income, also called net profit or net earnings. Which financial statement? Income statement. Definition. Profit after all costs of making that profit have been deducted. Number two, book value, also called equity, plus dividends, if any. Book value, balance sheet. Dividends, cash flow statement. Definition, value of the business if it were closed down and all its assets were sold, assets minus liabilities, before any dividends were paid out. Number three, sales. Which financial statement? Income statement. Definition, amount earned from selling, or revenue. Number four, operating cash. Which financial statement? Cash flow statement. Definition, actual cash received from business operations. Note, some of the accounting numbers are called by various names depending on which section of the financial statements they're in. I'm sure there are very good reasons for this, but it's confusing and frustrating to an accounting novice like me. However, there's an easy workaround. If I run into a term I don't know, I search for it online to turn up its synonyms. I'd like to see each of the Big Four numbers growing at 10% or better each year, Dad said. Those are called the Big Four growth rates. Remember, Dad declared, these numbers are out the back window of the car. You're looking into the past, and the past doesn't promise anything about the future. That's why we do all this other research as well to decide if the company will reliably continue these trends. But wait a second. You said the Big Four have to grow each year. This company can never have a down year? No, it can. The most important thing is not actually the 10% growth. The most important thing is that it's consistent and predictable, looking over the occasional valleys and mountains. For example, one of Buffett's companies, See's Candies, is growing at about 4% per year for the last 40 years. It hasn't been linear, but looking at the long view, it's been very consistent. Well below your 10% goal. True, we would like to have 10% per year. But in a case like See's Candies, its growth is steady and predictable, and it generates great profits. So we know it has a durable brand moat. Other candy companies might also have a brand moat. It's not exclusive within an industry. If there's a down year on any of the Big Four numbers, find out why. If it makes sense to you, and the company recovered fairly easily, then don't worry too much about it. That made sense. Look for a reliable pattern, and look for how the company responded to breaks in that pattern. Now, Dad explained, take the Big Four growth rates and choose one overall growth rate to use for the company. You mean use the average growth rate? I asked. No, he said emphatically. Definitely not the average. This is a judgment call you're going to have to make based on your research. You have to choose what you think is the most likely growth rate going into the future. Remember, all the numbers you have are in the past, and there's no guarantee they will continue. Only your understanding of the company will let you make an educated guess about how much this company will grow. So, you've got to just choose the growth rate you're going to use. It's like taking the windage into account when you're shooting a gun. The wind could push the bullet either way, and you've got to estimate the aim based on your experience. What? I cracked up laughing. The windage? Like, the wind pushes the bullet and that's called windage? Yup, Dad laughed. I loved it. I named the growth rate that I was supposed to choose the windage growth rate. The windage growth rate was based on research into past growth rates and into what analysts thought the growth rate would be going forward. It was up to me to be conservative with a lower estimate of growth or aggressive with a higher estimate of growth. Having relayed this knowledge, Dad decided it was enough. We had dinner, and the next day, he flew off to Florida to play polo. Later that week, I laid out my investing office and tested it out. I was proud of myself. I actually sat down and pulled up the financial statements for a few real companies and organized the big four numbers for each company on a spreadsheet. I'm not gonna lie. It was painful. Accountants. They seem to call everything by a different name. Operating cash might be called cash from operations by another company. Or they put the financial statements in a strange order that made it hard for me to find what I wanted. The search tool became my friend, along with the internet in general, which told me what terms to search for. I discovered that most financial statements have 3 to 5 years of data on them. So a shortcut to getting 10 years of data was to pull the most recent 10K, annual company financial report available on the company website, and the one from 5 years ago. I calculated each growth rate for each year, ran the most recent 10, 7, 5, and 3-year average growth rates, and, based on my limited understanding of the company, made an educated guess at the windage growth rate. Footnote: besides the annual 10K document, this data is easily found on many stock research websites, including Yahoo Finance, Google Finance, Morningstar, Guru Focus, and my dad's toolbox at rule1investing.com. For more information about how I worked out these growth rates, go to my website at danielletown.com. Coca-Cola's windage growth rate was the most difficult because the company's numbers were a bit of a mess and recently had negative growth. I went conservative and chose 0% overall. Apple, on the other hand, had been growing slowly and steadily across all four growth numbers. Easy. Except that its growth was slowing and included a few negative numbers in recent years. Overall, I chose 8%. That's windage for you. That was enough for now. I was a bit excited to move on to researching the people running these companies. That, it seemed to me, was where the rubber met the road for my mission. Could I trust them to do a great job? Charlie Munger's third principle of investing: management with integrity and talent. I felt like I could research management myself, so I tried it out. It felt nice to take the initiative for the first time in this practice. A venture capitalist I know describes the process of finding a good startup investment like dating. You've got to hang out with the founder to see if you see the world the same way and if the chemistry is there. Is this someone you trust and want to spend a lot of time with? Because, as a venture capitalist, you've got to have both in a founder. VCs do all that founder dating in person. As everyone who's ever been on a blind date knows, people are often very different in person than they are on paper. Researching public company management is the same dating process, but most investors rarely get the chance to meet a CEO in person, so I had to learn to depend on secondary sources. I found a few CEOs I wanted to look into, created a folder in which to save the articles I found, and started searching online. I looked at biography. A lot of my biography questions are related to how easy or difficult it has been for this person to come up in the business world. Running a public company is no easy job. How did this person get there? Did they pay their dues, or was the path smoothly paved for them? Neither is better than the other. In fact, a well-connected and well-integrated CEO can be far better for a company than a hard-scrabble, pulled-himself-up-by-the-bootstraps type who knows no one but has mad skills. But I like to get a sense of their background. I looked at management style. Are they a skydiving-on-the-weekends entrepreneurial type like Richard Branson? Or a stay-the-course, keep-growth-steady-and-low type who you've never heard of? The Branson types make good copy for business writers who have to make stories interesting to make a living, and some subjects are easier than others to write 5,000 words about, but the other types often make more reliable managers. I looked at founder. If the current management team does not include the founder, they might be reacting to the founder's departure. Steve Jobs left Apple the first time because the board thought someone else could run the company better than he could and forced him out. While the board might have been right at the time, what they missed was that no one could make Apple products better than Jobs could, so the company went into decline until he came back. When he returned, older and wiser, he not only saved the company, he led the creation of iconic products that changed entire industries. Knowing that story is pretty important to understanding the current managers of Apple and the length of Jobs' shadow on them. I looked at the board of directors. The board of directors hire and fire the management team. I tried to see if I could determine how they've handled doing both of those things. I looked at ownership. Sometimes CEOs leave, knowing they're out before the problems hit. So I look for founders or executives with a large shareholding stake, so they are literally invested in the long-term success of the company. As I read the press about a given CEO, gradually, article after article, I got a feel for what they were like. Were they warm, authoritarian, family-oriented, community-oriented, mission-oriented? Were they an industry specialist, a CEO for hire, a serial entrepreneur? Did they manage time well, have business loyalty, or move around a lot? I looked for clues and developed a bio in my notes, and I acknowledged to myself constantly that this bio was only based on impressions I'd gathered from incomplete information. Except for a very few famous CEOs, not all the information I wanted was out there. For many CEOs of non-famous companies, almost no information was out there about them. The absence of information told me that this was not someone who had been under the press's microscope. The conclusions I could draw, then and now, from researching CEOs are dependent on what an online search turns up, on how much press attention the management and the company have gotten, and how much scrutiny that attention has given the officers. This is where we hope the Fourth Estate protects us potential investors. We can't have access the way the press can, so we are stuck depending on their choices and on what's called for editorially that week or that month. There's a lot we don't control or can't know about. Dad, taking time out from his polo practice schedule in Florida to talk to me on the phone, sounded a bit pained when I mentioned that I had been looking into management. Management is one of the hardest parts of this whole thing. Did you notice that Charlie said he would like to have a management team with integrity? And that was kind of weird. Well, it's because it's so hard to know if people are trustworthy or not until things go bad. Charlie and Warren are masters at judging people, but they haven't been able to describe how they do it, and they definitely have made some mistakes over the years. As a counter to making a mistake about management, Buffett once said that you should only invest in a business an idiot could run, because one day, an idiot will. Another way to gather information about executives is to read their letters to shareholders, though they hardly ever reveal anything important, which is, in itself, a notable piece of information. Rule number one style hedge fund manager Matthew Peterson advised, when management is talking in terms of per share growth and free cash flow and internal rates of return, it is a signal that they share a value investing mindset and consider things through a capital allocation lens. Watching the vocabulary in public statements can be very informative. Warren Buffett's shareholder letters are famous for being the apotheosis of straightforward to the point of bluntness. How open is the CEO in the letter? Does the CEO announce bad news will come? And does he or she do so in a way that is intellectually honest? I had the massive advantage of 2020 hindsight. Did what the CEO predict come to pass? How closely to the time frame and the description the CEO gave did the prediction happen? What's the scuttlebutt around the internet about what the company's employees think about their management team? I saved all my research so I would never have to search for it again and wrote, for myself, an overall pronouncement on each CEO I researched, however vague. For example, seems decent enough, can't get much of a read, college and business school, then straight into management programs, seems to have been moving up the ladder since then. While reading business news and news about CEOs, I noticed that I regularly came across executives whom I had not intentionally researched. I created a list of executives to watch, Executives move around to different companies sometimes. That person may not be at a company I want to focus on right now, but maybe in 10 years they would be. And I would have already done the legwork to get a feel for them. Plus, then I'd have 10 years of evidence to see if my feel was right on. This reading contained great gossip. Who had worked with whom? Who left which company for another company after an embarrassing personal scandal? Who got paid way too much? I love the inanity of celebrity gossip, and looking into management is basically the same thing. There are scandals and divorces, and bad guys and good guys, and undisputed kings and queens of the financial world. It's even a glamorous world, though in a different way from Hollywood. Still, I did find it difficult to get all the information I wanted. Business journalists can be quite good, but they can't cover everyone, and they can't see into opaque companies. Someone hiding that they're embezzling from their company isn't going to be caught by a reporter doing a puff piece, nor even by an investigative reporter, necessarily. How many fawning articles about the Enron officers were there, probably in which they posed with leather-bound books in rooms that smelled of rich mahogany, before Enron went down? While the most well-known public company officers are certainly scrutinized, a takedown of them would be front-page news. For smaller companies, no one in the press has the time to care as much. I called my dad back the next day to tell him how much I was enjoying researching management. "Studying management is the best part of this whole thing," I exclaimed. He laughed, incredulous. "I thought you'd hate how you wouldn't be able to get much information." "No, it's totally like celebrity gossip, but I do feel a bit like I'm looking through the lens of the news and it's all a little fuzzy." "I have part of the solution, actually," Dad replied. "Really?" I said, excited. "Yup, numbers," I balked. "Management can't have numbers." "Oh yes, management can," he retorted gleefully, loving how much I wanted to avoid this. "And they will help you determine who is a good manager with an insight that is different and more objective than reading the gossip about them will." I sighed. Fine. I was just starting to love my management gossip, and he throws it back to the numbers. Bloody effing numbers. All right, give them to me. Management numbers. 1, return on equity. 2, return on invested capital. And 3, debt. Remember book value, one of the big four numbers? No, I admitted. Book value is the same as equity, which typically means ownership in corporate law. It's on the balance sheet. What we want to know is what return the company is making on that equity. That's what matters. And your money, in financial speak, is equity. It's a number called, get this, return on equity. This is major. I couldn't help it. I laughed at him. "It's so major." "It is," he insisted. "And you're going to love this. Return on equity is an easy number to find." Multiple sites online will tell you what it is. It's a standard number that any finance source will have calculated. "Wait, it's not on the financial statements?" "Well, not as such. It's a calculation from numbers that are on the financial statements." Return on equity is net income found on the income statement divided by equity found on the balance sheet. The equation is return on equity equals net income divided by equity. Return on equity, or ROE, tells us the return the company is getting on our shareholder investment. It calculates how many dollars of profit a company generates with each dollar of shareholder equity, which tells us if the management is doing a good job with our money. Now, a high ROE can be financially engineered just by the company borrowing a lot of money. I groaned. Return on invested capital is the other number we're going to use to look at management. Return on invested capital tells us the same thing as return on equity, but in addition to the money put in, it also includes the company's debt. The equation is return on invested capital equals net income divided by equity plus debt. What is a good and what is a bad ROE and ROIC number? Look for a company with an ROE and ROIC at 15% or better each year for the last 10 years or so. 10 years probably means they've been through a down economic cycle, or they've outgrown their startup phase, or they've been through a change of executive team. If they still have a strong ROE, this is a company to look at. Charlie wants us to look at durability, and shorter than 10 years is not enough to prove that a company is durable. Just as it is with people, consistency is important in a company. Consistency doesn't necessarily mean I can predict what it will do in the future, just as inconsistency doesn't necessarily mean that the company will continue to be inconsistent. But consistency does lend some confidence to the idea that a company will do what it says and says what it will do. One last number to check the management, Dad noted. Debt. Debt can be corrosive. And if they have a lot, it might give management an excuse to go into a prepackaged bankruptcy where they can dump the shareholders and emerge owning a big part of the company. If there is any long-term debt held by the company, we require the company to be able to pay it off with 1 to 2 years of earnings. I want the debt to be zero, preferably. Debt scares me. Debt is a great way for management to be able to manipulate the financials. And I know enough about myself to know that I'm not good enough with financial statements to suss out manipulation. Let's review the management numbers on a company my dad and I made up. A lemonade stand. We use this example because it's straightforward, plus I had a few real lemonade stands when I was a kid in Iowa, and there was an early Macintosh computer game in which you manage a lemonade stand that I was obsessed with and played for hours after school. Lemonade stands have all the same components as a more complex business. We brilliantly named our example business the lemonade stand. The lemonade stand has $1,000 of equity, $1,000 of debt, for $2,000 total. The company made $100 on that money. The ROE is $100 of net income divided by $1,000 of equity, equals 10%. The ROIC is $100 of net income divided by $1,000 of equity plus $1,000 of debt, equals 100 divided by 2,000, equals 5%. On the equity alone, the company made 10%. On return on invested capital, equity plus debt, the company only made 5%. I discovered a cool shortcut to checking the debt when looking at the management numbers. By looking at the difference between ROE and ROIC, I quickly know if and how much debt is involved in this business. With zero debt, the ROIC will be the same number as the ROE. Guess what? My dad teased. You're already reading financial statements without even realizing it. All those numbers you just used for moat and management? From the financial statements. Oh yeah, I smiled. He was right. I didn't love pulling them, but it wasn't hard, and I knew why I was doing it, and how to use those numbers to develop my argument for or against a company. In the service of my own knowledge, the financial numbers became useful to me, and that made all the difference. I still didn't want to move on to valuation. It had been a heavy-duty investing practice weekend. When I reflected, I felt uncertain about my company evaluation and financial skills. I felt like I had started learning a new language. Sometimes I recognized the words or lines of numbers, but most of the time I didn't. I didn't want to get ahead of myself and push too much new information into my brain too quickly. I needed to practice what I had learned for a while before adding to it. "Go play polo," I told him. "Don't forget rule number one. Don't fall off the horse." "I'll try not to," he promised. We hung up the phone. Formal investing practice time was over, but I was thinking about how to organize all this information I had gotten that month. I needed to add something to my own development of my practice. Checklists. I use checklists for repetitive tasks in my legal work to great effect, and it was time to get one going for my investing practice. I found I had great support from the value investing tradition of masters. Investors Monish Pabrai and Guy Spier have both written at length about how useful checklists are to their investing practices. It sounds like a Pippa tip from Pippa Middleton. Checklists are terribly useful for many endeavors in which you need to remember certain items, such as grocery shopping, lawyering, and investing. It's like that feature in Us Weekly of paparazzi photos of famous people getting coffee, grocery shopping, wiping at a stain on their shirt called, "Stars, they're just like us. This is super successful investors. They're just like us." But, yeah, they are. And checklists work. The beautiful thing about checklists is that they are not emotional. In his seminal book, Complications, about training as a surgeon, Atul Gawande explained that doctors are human and they screw up, and that checklists have been a huge component of cutting down on doctor error. Doctors are intelligent people who still make mistakes because they are 100% sure they can remember everything, but they don't always. That arrogance can have dire consequences, and it is so easily remedied with a simple solution. Write it down, then follow what you wrote down. A checklist has to have a reasonable number of items. Too many and it's overwhelming, and you spend more time checking off the checklist than using it. Too few and you'll skip things. It becomes useless. Checklists that are too detailed, for instance, have actually contributed to airplane crashes. There's a strangely addicting German TV show called Mayday about investigations into plane crashes, and while it's not my favorite thing to watch reenactment after reenactment of terrible airplane crashes, I've learned a lot about what to do in an air emergency. In one crash, the engine literally fell off the airplane. It turns out, I swear this is true, there is a "your engine has fallen off" emergency procedure checklist, which was too long for the pilots to complete before the plane crashed. And a checklist's entire reason for existence in this world is to be useful for its purpose. Otherwise, tear it up, burn it, feed it to the dog, it ain't no good. Here's my checklist based on Charlie's four principles. We've also included a copy of it on the enhancement PDF for you to reference later. My checklist. Charlie's four principles. 1. Be capable of understanding. Is this company inside my circle of competence? Are any of my gurus buying or selling this company? What is my overall level of confidence with my research into this company? Describe the business and industry in one paragraph. Describe the challenges and economic cycles of this industry. What are the company's plans for growth? Will growth peak within 10 years? 2. Moat. What is the moat? How hard is it to compete with this company? Compare this company to its competition. What are the big four growth rates? Are they speeding up or slowing down? What is the windage growth rate? Is it speeding up or slowing down? Does the company have enough cash to last several years if it loses money? How were sales and earnings during the last recession? 3. Management. Does the CEO have integrity? How candid is the CEO's letter to shareholders? Does management talk freely to investors when things are going well, but clam up or disclaim responsibility when trouble occurs? How happy are its employees? Does the company have any debt? If yes, could it be paid with 1 year of free cash flow? Has the company indicated that it plans to take on debt anytime in the future? Is the management team buying or selling its company's stock? 4. Reasonable price with margin of safety. Nada. My checklist got a little thin at number 4. I was begrudgingly reminded that I hadn't focused the slightest time or attention on determining what a good price for a company was. How would one value a company, exactly? In the meantime, I was a little distracted. Nuno flew across the ocean, came to my house, and stayed for 3 weeks. May practice. It's crazy that it's only the 5th month of practice, but we already know Charlie's first 3 principles. Choose 3 companies you've gotten interested in from your reading, and calculate the moat and management numbers of each one, as well as the windage growth rate. And notice how you're using financial statements and financial terms like a boss. Chapter 6. Circling Competence. June. This month. Wish list. Brokerage account basics. Fantasy investing. Family tradition with money. It had been 6 months of investing practice, I realized with a start, as I laid out my investing office on the dining table and started preparing for my investing call happening soon that day. Nuno's visit had gone really amazingly, shockingly, surprisingly, happily, well. I barely knew the guy when he showed up, and I was nervous that my vacation brain had made a mistake I would pay for over the next 2 weeks. I'm an inveterate introvert, and I needed my space. Plus, my condo was a small studio apartment. Plus, I was back at work again, with all the stress that entailed. Was he dangerous? Or worse, boring? I made sure my sister knew his last name and employer, so she could track him down in case I turned up dead. And I went to pick him up at Denver International, vibrating with anxiety. But when the opaque double doors at the arrivals gate finally opened up and he bounced out, jumpy and eager and feeling to me exactly like the guy I remembered, and somehow magically, smelling wonderful after 9 hours on an airplane, I was pretty sure we were going to be okay. I asked him later if he had been nervous when he arrived, and he said, "No, I was excited." I still liked him more than anyone I had ever met. I noticed that he pulled less energy from me than any person I had ever been around. He, also utterly introverted, noticed the same about me. I wonder if that's what we recognized in each other the night we met, a rare equilibrium, ease. "I'm in trouble," I thought to myself one morning in my office towards the end of his visit. I was at the point of no return. I either had to pull back, tell him to leave, and keep my life straightforwardly simple, or jump irrevocably into the unknown with this man from another culture and continent. Love is like enlightenment. To move into that new state of being, there is necessarily a death of the previous version of you, an abandonment of what was before. It's for such a good cause that it usually happens unconsciously and gladly, but I viscerally felt my decision and what it meant for my future. I knew that it might not work out, that I might get hurt beyond hurt, that it might be beautiful, great, enlightening, and that it would change everything. I chose to jump. I had kept up my investing practice reading while Nuno was visiting, and discovered that, to my surprise, it was a bit of fun to share the public companies I liked with someone else. I got to share the gossip. I told him about Whole Foods, obviously, which he fell in love with from our very first visit to the flagship Pearl Street store. He started going there without me while I was at the office and bringing home new products I hadn't discovered. I'm not saying it was a relationship litmus test, but if it had been, he had just passed it. I had still been searching around for other companies to follow. "Did you know Lululemon is public?" I offered. "Everyone knows about Lulu." "Lala what?" Oh, right, he didn't do yoga. Suddenly, I felt like I was conveying a hot stock tip. "My yoga pants." He was suddenly interested. Oh. I tended to think everyone knew about the same consumer companies, but, obviously, I realized at that moment, we don't. Nuno, a car aficionado, told me why he liked certain car companies that I hadn't known much about. My world of investing possibilities was expanding, and I had only been doing research for a few months. I was already more attentive to the companies in my world than I was before starting my investing practice. It happened without my even trying, in prosaic activities like doing the grocery shopping. I thought that I had been an engaged consumer, aware of what I bought and where I put my money, but this was a new level of conscious consumerism. I had always tried to buy products made by bolder companies, and I pointed them out to Nuno proudly, until he asked if everything available in Boulder had been made by a bolder company, and then I toned it down. But I started looking at everything as a possible investment. I'd walk down the grocery store aisle, and the brands popped out at me like superimposed thought bubbles. Toothpaste companies! Nut-free protein bar companies! Frozen burrito companies! Who owned which? Where would the eventual down-the-rabbit-hole parent company search lead? Some of the products on the shelf were biologically related to each other, having been born of the same parent, but gave us no indication. Others were related by marriage, from mergers or purchases of companies. And it was all a big treasure hunt. Some companies were public, and I could actually buy them. Which was a crazy thought. It made this whole investing thing seem a bit more real. And it made a regular mundane chore like the weekly grocery run a lot more meaningful. So it was odd. In that moment after Nuna left, when I put out my photos and lit my scented candle, that I didn't feel so excited about my investing call that day. We were halfway done with our year together, Dad and I. The thought brought on a deep breath. It felt a bit heavy, this investing practice of mine. My trepidation had subsided considerably since beginning my practice. After 6 months, the financial world was no longer a total black hole of mystery, and I was getting ever more sure that I could do this investing thing myself just as well as one of those finance people, without paying their fees, thank you very much. Still, in my less guarded moments, my reservations persisted. If I was honest with myself, I felt uncomfortable truly committing to my investing practice. I had come a long way in the last 6 months, I acknowledged, trying to give myself a little pat on the back for all the work I had done. I'd been giving my practice the good old college try by following what my teacher said to do, practicing, reading, and even experimenting with my own versions of investing practice. But I continued to feel like an outsider looking in on value investors as a whole. It was like being at a great party of investors, where I knew only the host, and I was awkwardly wallflowering around on the outskirts, trying to find anyone else I knew so I could join in. I could see everyone having fun, I was there, but I wasn't really a member of the nucleus. This sense of detachment made little rational sense. After all, I actually was starting to like this stuff. I wanted to learn it. I spent time on it. I had found ways to make it my own, as with my investing office, but doing so also emphasized to me how different I was from those finance people. Why wasn't I truly passionate about it yet? Why hadn't I found my friends at the party? Despite my growing comfort with it, when I thought of the financial world, what came up were those same old feelings and images. Stress, uncertainty, the unknown, it being too complicated to ever know, fear, lying liars who lie, numbers, financial statements, calculations, computer models, fees, the Great Recession, and depressions. It felt nasty. It felt like the opposite of the freedom I was starting to feel in my investing practice. In my mind, I tried something. I skipped to imagining I had achieved the end goal, feeling free. Immediately, I saw the words abundance and happiness, and imagined getting to do the stuff I wanted to do, relaxed, stress-free. I saw myself looking happy. Even the stress in my stomach felt a bit lighter when I imagined financial freedom. I reminded myself that my bridge to that freedom was my value investing practice. So I tried to picture myself being a successful value investor. I surveyed my investing office, closed my eyes, and tried to visualize it. I tried, but I couldn't. It was the strangest thing. I literally could not picture myself as a successful investor. In my mind's eye, I was there, but there was dark fog obscuring that image of me, the same fog that my dad seemed to have a lighted path through. It occurred to me, wouldn't it make sense that my image of myself as a successful value investor be modeled on my dad? Didn't I have a real-life role model for it? Shouldn't this be the easiest visualization exercise ever? But no, my image of a successful investor didn't look or feel at all like my dad. And I noticed that I felt a bit panicky in my chest after having that thought. Did I not want to be like my dad? I felt nauseated. I needed to sit down. I pulled out a dining chair and tucked myself into the table with my head in one hand, messing with my prayer wheel with the other. I was tapping into something hard, something tough, and something very old, and I didn't like it one bit. I had gone into my corporate big law legal career to save myself from the fear of the financial world by not having to deal with it. I'd make my money another way, and feel the financial freedom without ever having to touch that side of money. But it hadn't worked at all. My career hadn't created any of the feelings I associated with financial freedom. On the contrary, it had seemed to make everything worse. I got some water, took a breath. I was tired of dealing with these mysterious feelings of stress and avoidance. In my mind, the joy of financial freedom had not fully entwined itself with the idea of investing. They were actually separate and opposed, which made no sense. I had tried a few times to get closer to what my dad did in investing, and eventually had avoided it each time.